session number 6125, reel 2.
The Hail, tape 2.
Well, we learned that we were going to go to Hong Kong, and of course the first thing we looked at was what sort of weather they had there. We've been reduced, right up in Lahore, we were used to a very, very dry heat, which, as we know, Lahore is in the Sindh Desert. It was very dry. We had no deaths, except one man died with erysipelas. He was a groom at the stables, and that gave me my insight into my first military funeral, which was very, very impressive. Just before I leave India, there's one job I had which I found very interesting. I was called upon to play for a striptease show, and of course I saw that it lasted for quite a long time. A great fun was held by all. I think it lasted about a month till their regular pianist came back. But it was great fun in Lahore.
Was that connected with the military in any way?
Well, only in as much as they applied to the army band to see if they got a pianist who would be prepared to do it, as it was difficult to come by pianists in Lahore. You would always reckon the military establishment had a pianist somewhere about. And I was fortunate enough in being called by, as being a senior pianist then at that time, of course, exercised my Lance Corporal stripe and got the job of being the striptease pianist. Yes, I say it was great fun. Good time was had by all. It stood me in good stead for a job that I'll mention later that I had in China. But going back to the heat, as I said, we were used to dry heat in India. We saw by the papers that in Hong Kong the temperature was 80 to 85. We thought, oh, no problems here. Be great. But the only thing we overlooked, of course, was it was a different kind of heat. In Hong Kong, we had the humidity, which sometimes was over above what the temperature was. You get a temperature of 80 and you get a humidity perhaps of 81. Which made life very, very difficult because you used to suffer with all sorts of skin trouble, skin diseases, prickly heat notably, and you just couldn't get dry. But to go back a bit, we left India, I think it must have been about in January. I left from Bombay. We came down by troop train, six to a carriage, iron carriages with iron bunks, and we just had an Indian blanket called a durry, which we just laid out. The water provided was all you had in the day was what was provided in the actual compartment for six men. It was providing what they call a chatty, an earthenware pot. And surprisingly enough, the water was put in there was warm, and in the course of the day, that water would get ice cold. And to cool it down, if you still more, you want to cool it down in a hurry, you just used to throw more water, and by a process of evaporation, the water used to get cool. And we came down from Lahore. I think we had 3 or 4 days' journey from Lahore down to Bombay, embarked again on board a troop ship. I think it was the Dilwara, and went via Colombo, where we called in for a short time. In Ceylon, as it was then, Sri Lanka as it is now, then down into Singapore, stayed in Singapore for about a day and a half, where we had a look round the notorious Changi barracks, where the prisoners of war were put by the Japanese some years later. And we went straight from Singapore across the China Sea, as I think it was, where it was pretty rough. We didn't think we'd get seasick, but we did. And finally ended up in Hong Kong. Most wonderful place. And to me, it was to come home from home. The whole battalion, really, as far as the men were concerned, went haywire. Remember that some of them had been out abroad for 4 or 5 years, coming up for 6 years. They hadn't seen any white girls, only the untouchables in the married quarters, perhaps, or the officers' wives. Quite a number of Eurasians and black, or coloured women, and they'd seen no white women of their own. Of course, as soon as we reached Hong Kong, they found the red light district, which they found very quickly. When I say they, I mean the unit as a whole, and found the girls there very, very attractive. And of course, the girls realised via the grapevine, which they was always very, very much in evidence in Hong Kong. They learned where we came from, and of course, made a beeline for the troops, and good time again was had by all. They found the Chinese girls very, very attractive, and in the fullness of time, quite a number of marriages took place. You had to get permission of your commanding officer, of course, to marry, but these Chinese girls, who were very, very attractive, could stretch the money. They could live on things that, in a way, that our people weren't used to living, but they were able to provide. In the town of Hong Kong, a living accommodation to get their husbands away from the army barracks. And of course the men then drew marriage allowance, and white girls or girls of their own race being absolutely unobtainable, quite a lot of marriages took place, and these girls, they made marvellous wives. They stood by their men. And even when they became prisoners of war, these girls used to come up to the wire, and although they were shot and bayoneted and ill-treated generally by the Japanese, they still came, and until virtually very few of them were left, all their husbands got sent to other parts by the Japanese.
About how many in your battalion married Chinese girls?
I suppose 20 or 30 marriages took place over the time that we left Hong Kong till the time the war broke out, which was quite a high proportion, really, because if one remembers that some of the men were coming up to time expired and were going due to go home, and then, of course, the war breaking out in 39, a lot of our most useful people were creamed off and sent back to the UK, and of course we were replaced by conscripts and volunteers. So 20 or 30 marriages of the old regulars, the old stock that came from India to Hong Kong, was quite a good proportion. Of course, unfortunately, VD became rife. 80 or 90% of the battalion, despite all the terrible hardening squads that used to be in force for anybody who caught VD. The whole garrison was absolutely riddled with it. Various schemes were mooted that the girls should be medically examined, but even if they were examined and found to be infected, they'd start a course of treatment, but that never stopped them engaging in prostitution again. They just couldn't wait to get on the job.
What about the men? What precautions were taken to...
Well, men had to... were provided with French letters and a cleaning outfit, which had to be produced to the guard commander before you went out. You had to carry a minimum of 3 French letters, and if you decided you wished to go with a woman, you had to use the cleaning material before you had intercourse. Then you'd use the sheath, and then you had to come back to various, what they called ET rooms, I think they were called. They were medical centres dotted right throughout the colony, where you had to go and have what they called a can-up with permanganate of crystals, and generally wash and clean down at these ET centres. And a medical corps orderly used to be in charge these centres, and he used to sign a certificate to the effect that you had attended this these centres. Well, the punishment was to a certain extent mitigated if you'd gone through all the treatment and you were able to produce your medical certificate that you had attended the centre. If you did that, a certain amount of mitigation did take place. But if you were a lance corporal, you lost your stripe. If you were a sergeant or a full corporal, you came down six places. I believe there were certain punishments for the officers, but what they were, I don't know. But where the men were concerned, the punishment was pretty fierce. It didn't stop it. They had hardening squads where men had to pray for 2 or 3 hours every day until their treatment was finished, or from a period when the medical officer said they could start their treatment, start their hardening squad. This went on for weeks as part of punishment, which a former lance corporal would have to do. In addition to losing his tape, he'd have to do his hardening squad. Every week, men who were garrisoned in Hong Kong, in my particular battalion, sometimes I had the job if I was, I'd been promoted then, if I was orderly sergeant, or was at one time orderly corporal, used to have to get the VD people together. They used to have a formal parade, and they used to be marched down to the staff ferry, across on the ferry, and marched to the military hospital onto the mainland side, Kowloon, for treatment. There was no M&B 693 at the early stages of our garrisoning of Hong Kong. That came in later. M&B 693 was a sulfur drug. Of course, there was no penicillin. And the treatment that was meted out, particularly to syphilitic patients, was so very, very fierce that you'd think that no one would undergo such treatment again. I mean, they were just virtually tied down and held down, and all sorts of instruments were used on them. Men used to yell and scream, say, never again, never again. But they'd go again even before their treatment was finished. The treatment, the main treatment was arsenic. Arsenic, a hypodermic needle was put in the buttocks with the arsenic in, and they'd have so many treatments of arsenic, and then because that broke down all the veins in the body, they weren't able to have any tooth out or undergo any major operation while they were on arsenic. And to counteract the effects of the arsenic on the bloodstream, they used to have bismuth. Injections, of course, of bismuth. So it used to be arsenic and bismuth, until such time as medical officer said either A, you're clear, or B, you've been and gone and reinfected yourself. Well, of course, they reinfect the girls again, so it became just a vicious circle. But of course, the Army's point of view was, and quite understandably, that if you caught VD, you made yourself unfit for military service. And of course, that's what military service is all about, that you keep yourself fit and at all times ready to do any sort of job that you're called upon to do. But life as a bandsman, if you looked after yourself, and in me particular, because I had the one instrument really that one could really have good fun on, you were always accepted, providing you were prepared to go along and play anything that was wanted. And as an army pianist, that was a job you had to make yourself efficient at. I mean, if they wanted a certain song, well, you played it. Couldn't take music around with you. And of course, dance bands in Hong Kong, we had no rivals there. There were the 1st Battalion of the Middlesex had a very good band, but we had the edge on them. really, we had a very, very good band, and also there's something that very few regiments had, line regiments had. We had a very, very good full orchestra. Very few military bands were able to put out an orchestra of, say, 10 or 15 violins and the necessary backup instruments of cellos and bass violins. This was due in a large effect, the fact that we had such a wonderful band at home. Our band was 80 strong, the 1st Battalion home under Bandmaster Rhodes, who subsequently became senior director of the Brigade of Guards. He became Lieutenant Colonel Rhodes. But he was so keen on his career as a bandmaster that during his time as bandmaster of the 1st Battalion, he did look after us in the 2nd Battalion and feed instrumentalists of a very, very high calibre. In as much as we were able to field a very, very good orchestra. And, of course, being in Hong Kong, where there's, even in those days, there was a mass of hotels, the big President Line boats used to come in from the States. They used to be absolutely filled with women who used to buy all their underclothes in Hong Kong because cheap labour up on the China coast, up at Swatow, there used to be the Swatow lace companies, which for a mere pittance used to be employed in making all the wonderful lace for the women's garments. Because silk was very cheap. That used to come down from mainland China. We used to get all our clothes, silk shirts, all our civilian clothes. Whereas, by the way, we weren't allowed civilian clothing in India, other ranks. Just as we reached Hong Kong, other ranks were allowed civilian clothing. So that, of course, that made life as a soldier at another rank much better in Hong Kong. And what with the civilian clothing and the very, very attractive Chinese girls and the general level of entertainment that was possible, the beaches, where you could swim virtually all the year round in the beaches. There was always good programs of rifle shooting on the ranges, plenty of cricket, although, of course, we had plenty of sport in India. We came out to Hong Kong, of course, the real champions at hockey, and we swept anything that the China station liked to put in front of us. We were able to just to wipe them up with hockey because we'd been well trained in India, whereas we didn't do so good against the all-Indian teams, of course. We were more than a match for anything that they could sling up against us. Of course, there was a very, very big garrison, a naval garrison. A very, very big naval garrison. There was nothing to see. Six or eight cruisers and destroyers and an aircraft carrier in the harbour. American warships used to come in, and there's something I missed when I went back to Hong Kong in recent years, looking over in the harbour. No warships, no President Line boats coming, these great big liners used to come in. I remember the Empress of Britain, who was later sunk, I believe, in the Atlantic during the war. She came into Hong Kong, I suppose, in about 1938. And we used to go out drinking in the band when we had no band duties. We used to go to the Hong Kong Hotel, the Gloucester Hotel, in our civilian clothing. We used to enjoy our drinks in there as civilians. And we used to sit in on the orchestra of the Hong Kong Hotel. And I would take over the piano sometimes, because the orchestra of the Empress of Britain, they found their way to the Hong Kong Hotel, and of course we got very friendly with them. And quite a number of us went on board the Empress of Britain, and we gave them a session on board that on that lovely boat one evening.
Was your life much freer than the life of the average member of the
band? Oh, as a bandsman, it was very free. I joined the Hong Kong Cathedral Choir, and our regiment, of course, was a Presbyterian regiment, but we used to have to play at a used to play at a C of E service once a month, which was attended by a General Grassette, who was a GOC of Hong Kong, and Vice Admiral Sir Percy Noble, and the Governor, by his name for the moment. But they used to attend the monthly C of E service, and I used to play the organ, and the orchestra of the Royal Scots used to perform by having the chancel, much to the disgust of the then Dean, Wilson, who became Bishop of Singapore. After we'd been there about 12 months, he left us. Well, he left the Hong Kong area, and he went and became Bishop of Singapore. Subsequently, he was taken prisoner of war in Singapore, and he, for many years, until his death about 3 or 4 years ago, he led the service of remembrance at the Albert Hall. He used to be a very big beard after he was captured in Singapore. I believe he was tortured. But he didn't like the Royal Scots. He didn't like us because we had to be in uniform, and he didn't like our army boots around his chancel. And because he didn't like it when I used to clatter up to the organ loft. He didn't like it. I must admit, I didn't play the organ in army boots.
How many of you were there in the cathedral choir then?
In the choir? Mm. Well, I was the only member of the choir because I was rather proud professor of a very, very good singing voice. And I had my voice trained in Hong Kong by a Professor Gualdi, an Italian professor. Several Italians in Hong Kong, we had one or two, used to come in and teach us the finer points of some of the instruments. I used to play at the cello. The instrument I was put on when I joined the Royal Scots was the clarinet, and that was my military band instrument, which I used as marching. I never became very proficient at it. I think I got the wrong shape mouth, probably too big or something. Anyway, it never seemed to become much of a clarinet player. But I used to play at the cello, my presence on the cello was never really necessary because you used to have a very, very big orchestra whenever you would do away with a piano, and I was always needed for the piano anyhow because we never had a harp in the band, so I would naturally play all the harp parts. Yes, I did have a very, very good voice, fortunately enough, and I went to an Italian professor in Hong Kong, Professor Gualdi, I think his name was, and I asked him if he'd try my voice, and he said, "What do you think you sing?" I said, "I think I sing bass." He said, "I don't think so." But he showed me into his music studio, and all on the desk, on his seat, very comfortable, were all literature, all about Mussolini, and it was the time that Mussolini had gone into Eritrea. And it was all about the armed might of the Italians. And while I was waiting for my appointment with him, it's time when I used to sit and browse at these magazines. But I didn't think, well, they look very impressive as glossy magazines do, because we never had very much in the way of armour in Hong Kong. But anyway, I went into Gualdi and asked him if he'd give me a voice test, and he said, "What do you think of singing?" I said, "Bass." He said, "I don't think so." He said, "We'll try." So he took me down the scale and he said, "Oh, it's not bass, he said, it's just horrible noise." He said, "You are a tenor." I said, "Tenor?" I said, "I've never sung tenor." He said, "You are in a cathedral choir, you tell me." I said, yeah. He said, "You sing what?" I said, "Well, bass, baritone." He said, "You are a pure tenor." He said, "Not a bass." He said, "Try this." He took me up the scale a bit higher than I've ever been before. He said, "No, your voice could be pushed up." I said, "Well, do you think I have a voice?" He said, "You have a very pleasant voice. People will like to listen to it. Not a Caruso, mark you. But, yes, your voice is very pleasant. And it can be improved. Do you think it's worth spending money?" "Yes," he said. "Yes, I suppose that's a question he would answer with the affirmative, saying it would be my money he'd be getting. However, I did have quite a number of lessons, very enjoyable ones with Professor Gualdi. In fact, he was putting on a show. He was putting on La Cavalleria Rusticana, and he wanted me to sing the part of Alfio in it with his other pupils. But we never got around to that because I had the experience of when war broke out of interning poor. I was in charge of the party that interned poor Professor Gualdi in Hong Kong until we sent him back to Italy.
But that was in 1939.
That was in 1939-40 when they interned all the Italians and any spare Germans waffling around. And I was, as I say, in charge of the party that collected poor Professor Gualdi.
Were many people interned?
Quite a number. quite a number, but of course we had the Middlesex Regiment there. They were doing the same. When war broke out, we had the Kamayan Regiment there with us, two regiments of Kamayans. They sent those home, and in 39 they weeded through the men they thought would be most useful for UK forces, and of course weeded through the officers, apart from just one or two Amur go-ahead provision officers were taken away from us. From 39 onwards, of course, we had no more recruits to the band. And, of course, nobody could leave the band. Nobody, I suppose, could leave the... Well, because there was a bit of interchanging amongst people in the companies, but the band... There's no more bandsmen coming from the UK, so the bandmaster, who was Bandmaster Jordan, he joined us in India. When I joined India, we had a band's home. We were without a bandmaster. The bandmaster there, I think, had died. And we were under the charge of the band sergeant. But just after I arrived in India, about 2 or 3 months later, Bandmaster Jordan joined us straight from Nellah Hall. He, of course, stayed with us into Hong Kong. And he had to hang on tight to anything that he could get. But we did very, very well money-wise. We used to pay a military band at the racecourse. Orchestra in the Peninsula Hotel, or any jobs that were going at any of the hotels.
How frequently were these engagements?
Oh, five and six, seven nights a week, a dance band. And every week during the racing season would be down at Happy Valley with military band. And we used to play at Chinese weddings. Had a lot of Goanese there, which, as you know, is the southern, one of the southern states of now India. That used to be... its own, there used to be a state of Goa where the Indians went in and cleared that out there. But the Goanese used to provide quite a number of bands. Down in the red light district of Hong Kong, where the troops used to go for their dancing girls, dance hostesses, in Hong Kong, the dance hostesses in the dance halls there were cheek by jowl. There were ever so many of them. And you'd go and you'd buy a book of tickets. And if you were a regular there, you'd probably have your own girl you preferred to dance with, and you'd give her the book of tickets. And you'd dance, and each ticket one dance, until you'd used your book of tickets, perhaps on your one girl. And you used to look upon her as your girl. We in the band used to go down quite often for the fun and games that used to be going on, and we used to sit in the band, mostly, as I say, Goanese, some Indian, not very many Chinese used to play, as I remember, instruments, but mostly coloured, and we used to sit in on the instruments, whatever was going, and